This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. How about a break from politics? Are you ready for some really interesting science? We've got some really interesting stuff for you this hour. How about a robotic heart assistant? You know, heart failure affects nearly 6 million adults in the United States. It strikes when the heart weakens and can no longer flush enough blood and oxygen through the body to the tissues and the organs that need it. But what if you could give the heart a little robotic assist, a little extra squeeze to help it do what the muscle is too weak to accomplish by itself? That's exactly what my next guest has invented, a squishy robot that fits around the heart and can help broken hearts pump blood again. For now, though, it's only working in pigs being tested. Ellen Roach is the lead author on the work, published in the journal Science Translational Medicine. She's a postdoctoral researcher at the National University of Ireland. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Roach.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Can you describe for us how this thing works exactly? It fits around the heart like a cup holding it?
Yeah, of course. It's kind of like a sleeve that fits on the outside of the heart, and it helps the heart to pump without contacting the blood. So it's made of a silicone matrix with embedded actuators, and when you pressurize them with air, it makes the device contract and twist, and this helps the heart to pump blood in heart failure patients.
So it's like a little pacemaker is attached to it to make it squeeze?
Yeah, actually, in our trials, we used a pacemaker to trigger the actuation of the device, and simultaneously to pace the heart so that we knew that the device and the heart were in synchrony.
Okay. Can you actually restart the heart after a heart attack?
So typically after a heart attack, you know, there's a procedure called stenting where the heart is reperfused or the vessels are kind of open to restart the heart. But what can happen is that scar tissue can form and the heart can go into heart failure. So when the patient gets to end-stage heart failure, when they're not responding to medical management anymore, they get on a transplant list. And this device would act as a bridge to transplant to kind of help them to improve the pumping function of the heart while they're waiting to get a heart transplant.
Of course, what everybody wants to know is when will this be tested out in humans?
Of course, yeah. So at the moment, it's very much in the research phase, and we have a lot more work to do in terms of optimizing the device and miniaturizing the hardware, and a lot more animal testing to do, long-term animal testing to make sure that it's safe to implant in humans. So it'll definitely be a few years, but we're hoping to advance it along the path.
And it would be for people, I'm assuming, who are already experiencing heart failure.
Yes.
Yeah. Let me bring on another guest now, another innovator who's designing flexible bots that can assist muscles on the outsides of our bodies, too. Panos Polyarinos is an assistant professor in the School of Engineering at Arizona State University in Mesa, Arizona. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Now, I know that you're looking at some ways robots might help us move other muscles besides the heart, like in the hand with a robotic glove. Tell us about that.
Yes, of course. Similar to what Ellen has done to help the heart function and pump blood again, what we are trying to do is utilize soft actuators that consist of elastomeric chambers. And the idea over there is to put those on top of your fingers in people that have hand impairments and they are in need of hand rehabilitation or they require their hands to function to perform activities of daily living. So we're placing those soft inflatable structures on top of their fingers. We're matching the anatomy of the finger. And when we are pressurizing them with some fluids, for example, air, we can actually have the finger bend in synchrony with how we control the actuators. So that enables them again to grasp objects and perform activities of daily living.
Mm-hmm. How close are you to having something that might actually be available to people?
I would say, first of all, I must give credits to Harvard and the Biodesign Lab. I was working on that as a postdoctoral fellow with Professor Connor Walls, and they are taking this over along with the Wyss Institute in Boston, and we are trying to find potential investors to have this be a commercially available product for people that are in need of these type of devices. Mm-hmm. We have done our first trials, and we're moving ahead towards that.
Now, I understand that you're actually creating an artificial limb, sort of like a third arm, right?
Yes. Now, as an assistant professor at Arizona State University, I'm exploring other pathways on how we could assist all of these people that are suffering from pathologies on their limbs. And one of these things is, one of these ideas that we are developing with my students right now is to have a limb, a soft limb that branches out of your body and has a soft grasper in the end, soft actuators again, that allows you to control it with in the way that you want to be controlled and assist you in grasping objects, or even assist people that don't have impairments, but they really need of a third arm to execute tasks that are in need of a third hand.
And you're also working on a similar to that, a sort of bicep booster, an add-on robot that makes your bicep muscle stronger? Or is it sort of like a bionic person?
Yeah, the idea started with some clinicians that we're working with, and they were looking on how to decrease overuse muscle syndromes for the shoulder of users on wheelchairs. So the idea is these users are keep using their shoulders a lot, and they end up having problems with that. So how can we have soft muscles that can contract in a similar way that our biological biceps operate to actually give you that extra boost at the time that you need it to help you keep going without getting the fatigue on your muscles?
Ellen Roach, it's sort of like these soft robots are like physical therapists who massage you mechanically by a robot instead of having a real person inside and out.
Yeah, exactly. That's kind of one of the goals of these soft robotic devices, so they can augment the native function of different organs and parts of the body, and while being atraumatic and conformable and not causing any damage to the body.
What makes all of these devices robots? They look a lot different from what people might think of as a robot.
Sure, yeah, they're very different from conventional robots with rigid parts, but they're robotic in the sense that you can program them to achieve predefined motion. So, you know, you can just decide what motion you want to achieve and you pressurize them, but you design them so that they will move in a certain way. For example, in the heart sleeve, we've oriented the actuators so that they mimic that of the muscle of the heart. So we have circumferential and twisting actuators so that when we pressurize them, they squeeze and twist at the same time.
Wow. I'm sorry.
And yeah, I was going to say in Panos' glove, he can speak to that as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so soft robotics in general is giving a lot more advantages that we cannot get through rigid traditional robotic systems. Everybody is thinking of a robot as being something huge, bulky, very strong. So the idea right now is how can we use different type of materials that are softer, they are more compliant, they match the soft tissue of a human being to interact with a human being,
right,
and be inherently more safe. Decrease the cost of developing those devices. And most importantly, as Ellen said, we can customize the actuation based on patient's anatomy or based on the needs that patient has. So these are some of the benefits that soft robotics are bringing. That's why they are attracting a lot of attention lately, because we need to develop better systems, and all researchers around the globe are trying to figure out how we can make those better.
You know, I'm sort of thinking of these robots being used by older adults who have weakened muscle strength. They have trouble getting out of a chair or standing or walking. Help them from, you know, falling backwards or forwards. Might this be a use for this?
Oh, definitely. So there is another idea that we have started recently exploring in my lab, which is how can we create, let's say, soft orthotic devices for strengthening your back muscles.
Yeah,
that might be for useful also besides the impaired users. It could be for people that are doing sports. So, for example, you go out on a Sunday to play golf, but you have instructions not to strain your back muscles too much. So wearing that device under your clothes might actually help you support the muscle groups that are in need. So the soft robot mm-hmm. can detect what you're doing and at exactly the correct time give you that extra support that you are in need. And these are, again, some of the examples.
Yeah. Ellen, I would imagine that these devices have to be pretty intelligent and able to...
Yeah, definitely.
Able to adjust their own activity as the body changes and have a good feedback mechanism through the body.
Yeah, well, at the moment, our device is user-controlled. So, you know, we would, when the device is being placed, the cardiac surgeon would look at the heart beating and synchronize the actuation of the robot with the heart. And then as the patient, like the vision is as the patient, as the disease condition of the patient evolves, they could use imaging to assess how the native heart is functioning and then tune the actuation depending on what the patient needs. So at the moment, there isn't an inbuilt kind of feedback mechanism. It would be done by a surgeon or a doctor that's treating the patient.
Yeah, we don't hear much about soft robots. This is interesting, Panos, you know.
Yeah, it is indeed. As as you might know, this is a relatively new field in robotics. It doesn't count many years, but nevertheless, as I said earlier, it has attracted a lot of attention in the research community, at least.
Yeah,
it's going to be a few years. Yeah, it's going to be a few years before we start seeing prototypes and devices getting out there, but it's going to happen. So the future, I think, is bright. We're going to have these new types of robots that people are not used to. These are going to be part of our lives.
We'll have to change it from Iron Man to Plastic Mercury Man. Or soft,
yes.
Something like
soft
that.
Man.
Thank you, Dr. Roach. Thank you, Panos. Ellen Roach is postdoctoral researcher at the National University of Ireland, and Panos Palliarinos is an assistant professor in the School of Engineering at Arizona State University. We're going to take a break, and coming up, you're welcome. Reality is not what it seems. We'll discuss the nature of the universe with physicist Carlo Rovelli after this, the author of the book by that very name. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Now, I know you've heard of Galileo, the father of modern physics, and of course, Isaac Newton and Albert Einstein. But have you ever heard of Paul Dirac? Does the name John Wheeler, maybe John Archibald Wheeler, ring any bells? If you're a science geek, they are familiar names, both key players in the world of quantum physics. And we can add another name to that list, theoretical physicist Carlo Rovelli. Well, he's not quite Einstein or Dirac just yet, but Rovelli specializes in quantum gravity, a way to describe gravity using the principles of quantum mechanics. No one, not even Einstein, has been able to unite the quantum and gravity worldviews. And in his aptly named new book, Reality is Not What It Seems, he explores and explains how the universe is really a strange place. Carlo, welcome back to Science Friday.
Hi, thank you very much, Ira. Thank you for the wonderful introduction. Undeserved.
Hey, you know, we had you on for your last book, Seven Brief Lessons, where you explain physics through discrete scientific discoveries. But in this book, you sort of like took a tour, an historic tour. Is that the best way to understand modern physics, by looking backwards into history?
I do believe so. By following the path of discovery, we do get a grasp, we do get an understanding of modern physics much better, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. And you describe how there are these large gaps of time, sometimes hundreds of years, between discoveries. Looking back, was that unusual for those periods?
There have been periods in which there was a faster pace of discovery in history. There was certainly one at the beginning of the 20th century with Einstein and Schrödinger and Dirac and those people. There was one around Newton and Galileo, and there was one in the ancient times, in the with the Greek time. Mm-hmm. Overall, discovering the world is a complicated business, I believe, and it goes slowly. It has always gone slowly, and is still going slow now, I believe.
Well, why do you say that? Why do you say it's going slowly now? We keep hearing of all kinds of new discoveries.
Well, there is obviously an effect of perspective, right? Mm-hmm. One has always the impression that a lot of things are happening right now because the thing in the past are more diluted. We only see the important things. Certainly things are happening. Very interesting things are happening. I believe quantum gravity is among these. But if you look at the major discoveries, if, for instance, from now, if you go back, you have to go back to basically to the beginning of the 20th century, is a century for the big steps. So big steps require time, and new ideas are proposed. They have to be digested, they have to be checked. There's a long discussion, there are different schools debating. All this takes time. It's beautiful, but takes time. I think the sense of everything is happening fast now, it's a little bit misdirected, I would say.
You mentioned quantum gravity. Let's slowly tiptoe our way into this, and I want to get to by asking first, the second half of your book is about quantum physics and questions we don't have answers to. And so what is wrong with what we currently know about how the universe is put together? We have a theory, do we not? What is wrong? What doesn't fit?
We have two basic fundamental theories, and that's a problem. We have quantum mechanics that works extraordinarily well, and we use it for describing matter, for doing computers, for describing particle physics, the atoms, the nuclear forces, and all that. It works fantastically well. And then we have general relativity that also works very well and describes galaxies and stars and how things fall and the gravitational waves that were a big excitement last year. So all this is great, except that these two theories, at least at first sight, seem incompatible with one another. So clearly we have a problem. It's like students of physics that go to listen to classes in physics at the university. In the morning, they get one professor that says, look, the world is so and so and so. In the afternoon, they get another professor that says, the world is so and so. It's a completely different story. They cannot be both true. One of the two or both should be adapted to go with the other. So definitely we have a hole, something we don't understand in the texture of reality.
But isn't this a question that, as you say, for the last 100 years has occupied physicists to try to reunite these two ideas?
Yes.
Unsuccessfully so far.
Exactly. And that's why things are slowly. That's an example of how the progress is slowly. It's slow. There was a paper by Einstein in 1916, so we are a century and 1 year ago, in which he says, look, there is a problem. We have to figure out how gravity stays together with quantum mechanics. And nobody for the moment has solved that problem. Or maybe not. Maybe I've solved the problem. Maybe somebody else has solved the problem. There are theories around. There are tentative theories around. I describe one of these theories in my book, Loop Quantum Gravity. But we don't have experiments supporting them, and we don't agree with one another, the physicists, on which one is the right one.
Oh, okay, now that you brought it up, Carlo, let's get into loop quantum gravity a little bit, as much as we can. Let's first talk about things that have been talked about in recent past, string theory. Trying to explain everything. Is string theory no longer working for you?
Well, we are in the realm of what is not clear yet. So there are different opinions around. There is, and that's good. That's how science works, with different bands fighting one another. And from the discussion, clarity emerges. It's always emerged in the past. And we're in one of these periods. So there certainly are people around who work on string theory and still hope that string theory could provide some good answers. But there are people around who work in different direction and work in loop quantum gravity and are far more hopeful in different directions. String theory raised a lot of hopes in the 80s. I think it's a little bit more humble now. Some of the things that string theory people expected did not happen, did not work out. One example is a discovery of supersymmetry. String people were expecting discovery of supersymmetry, didn't arrive. Other things that people hope to compute with string theory turn out to be impossible. So we don't know for sure, but more and more people, I would say, are looking in other directions.
And so you're looking toward loop quantum gravity. Can you describe why you think that works. What is quantum gravity? Is it, from reading your book, it seems like you're trying to get to the tiny world that's, you know, that is down there and find the gravitational or the actual elements in smaller and smaller tiny places.
Exactly. So the problem between quantum on the one hand and general relativity on the other hand appears when we look at small things, and more precisely when we look at space at a very, very small scale. What the theory says, what the theory indicates is the case, is that we're immersed in space, but space is not continuous like we study at school. It's not well described by standard geometry. It's actually has a structure, has an atomic structure. So there are grains of space, quanta of space. Imagine we're not immersed in a continuous three-dimensional thing, but we're immersed in a granular thing. So there's a minimal possible bit of space, and that's what loop quantum gravity describes. The way this chunk of space interact with one another, the size, the shape, so to say, and how they make networks to one another. They form a kind of net,
right,
being attached to one another. In this net, loops, that's where the name loop quantum gravity come from. And that's a minute structure of space, or more precisely, of space-time. And the use of that is that if we have this theory, we should be able to understand what happens in places of the universe like the center of black holes or the Big Bang, which are places where we don't yet understand what's going on because we need a quantum theory of gravity for that.
So you're saying that in order to unite quantum mechanics and gravity, the Einsteinian way of looking at it is geographical, so to speak. It's the bending of the...
It's exactly geographical.
Geographical. If you get small enough, you go down tiny enough, you're saying we can actually see that the gravity is not this continuous bending that Einstein has, but it's like tiny, tiny, weeny little particles.
Exactly.
It's granular, and that way it's a quanta, like everything else that's tiny, it's really united that way. It's not as smooth as you think. It's really quantized. Would that be a way of summarizing it?
It's a very good way of summarizing it. Einstein discovered that space is like a rubber sheet that can bend and stretch. And if you fold quantum theory in, this rubber sheet is not, it actually has a texture, like a T-shirt. It's made by little small sort of particles, except, careful, these particles are not in space. They are space themselves. It's their collection that make up space. Like a T-shirt, a thread of a T-shirt is not in the T-shirt. It's just, if you take away all the threads, there's no T-shirt anymore. So here, if you take away all this grain of space, there's no space anymore, there's nothing. So this grain of space are the constituents of space, so to say.
Wow. Now, you know, in your book, there are a lot of really interesting and provocative things that of looking at quantum mechanics and looking at the universe. I mean, your book is titled Reality is Not What It Seems. And it quite really took me by surprise about some of the things you said and some of the things we take for granted in high school that we learned. And one of those is the notion of what an electron is. I mean, from our high school class, we think it's this object. And you say an electron is nowhere when it is not interacting. Things only exist by jumping from one interaction to another. And you also say, does it all seem a little absurd? I mean, so this electron is not what we were all taught about is in school, going around a little nucleus and doing that stuff?
Well, if you think about what you learn at school is a little bit contradictory, right? On the one hand, the electron is a little like little stone. On the other hand, there are these orbitals, these little clouds. The electron opens up in cloud. This is quantum theory. The quantum theory is a complicated theory that works very well. It's 100 years old. But it's a theory that when you look at it carefully, it's extraordinarily surprising. And I try in my book not to hide its mystery, its complication, and what it says about the world. The world is more complicated than our intuition. There's no doubt about that, right? Our intuition that Earth is flat and it's round. Right. Our intuition is that we don't move, but actually the Earth moves, and so on and so forth. So science is realizing that our intuitions are often naive. Things are more complicated, they're more beautiful, and they're very surprising when you go into them. It doesn't mean they're absurd or incomprehensible. It means that it takes time to digest and to accept the complexity and to discover the beauty of reality beyond its appearances.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. Talking with Carlo Rovelli, author of Reality is Not What It Seems. It really isn't when you read the interesting things in this book. And for example, we mentioned before, taking this idea further, about tiny little bits of space, that you quantize the space itself. And you say that there is a limit to how small you can make those little pieces of space. Why is there a limit? Why can't I just cut it in half again, you know?
Why shouldn't there be a limit? Why do you really believe that it's possible to that there is an infinite tower of smallness going into the small? That's very hard to believe.
That's why you get paid to think of that and not me, because I, you know.
That's right.
But you have an interesting idea about what happens when you get too small. What happens to the energy in the space? And something happens there, right?
Yes. Well, let me say one thing. It already happened with matter, right? We thought that matter was continuous, and it took quite some time to realize that matter is not continuous. It's atomic. It's made by atoms, by molecules, by particles. This was only understood about at the beginning of the 20th century, not before that. It's one of those ideas that is very old. It was suggested in ancient times. But it was realized recently. So matter is discrete, and light is discrete. It's made by photons. A wave of light is actually a cloud of photons. And it's not surprising, after all, that space itself is a sort of a cloud of little teeny small things. And yes, this requires changing notions like energy and all that. In a sense, physics as a whole has to be rewritten on the basis of this discreteness of space.
Well, you know, in the modern theory, not only are we talking about space, but time, right? Time is in the equations of Einstein. And is time divisible then into tiny little quanta, little pieces?
Yes, I think so. And the time is absolutely magic and mysterious things, because time is a mystery. We don't really understand time in the sense that the more we study it, the more we discover that it works differently than our intuition, right? For instance, clocks go faster in the mountains than near the ocean, and clocks go slower if you move them faster, and so on. There's a long story about time that tell us that time is a tricky, extremely tricky concepts. And I think we still don't have total clarity about time. It's one of these beautiful open questions in science on which so many people are thinking, and it seems to be connected with open problems like what is consciousness, what is life, what is inside a black hole, how the universe began. All this has to do with understanding what time really is, and I think we don't know yet.
Well, you have a lot of time to take those up in your next books. So I'm going to stay with us, Carlo. We're going to take a short break and come back and talk lots more with Carlo Rovelli. If you want a really interesting book about physics, time, all kinds of stuff in there, Reality is Not What It Seems, The Journey to Quantum Gravity. It's a great book to read. As I write on my Facebook page, I keep reading more and more quantum mechanics books, so maybe someday I'll understand it. This one will actually make you think about some interesting stuff. Stay with us. We'll be right back. More with Carlo Rovelli after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking with Carlo Rovelli, author of Reality is Not what it seems. And he is sort of shattering our concepts of space and time and all kinds of interesting things and trying to make all those quantized. What about, Carlo, let's move on to something that didn't exist up until a few years ago, or the knowledge of it, dark energy, dark matter. How do those fit into a larger shape of the mathematics and the workings of a universe?
I think that dark matter is it's a good proof that there's still a lot we don't know. There's still a lot we don't understand, and we're very far from the end of physics. The universe is still full of mysteries. We have understood a lot. It's unbelievable how much we have understood about the universe. We have the basic equations that describe so much of what happens, but these basic equations are clearly not complete. There's else. And dark matter has come as a surprise. Nobody ordered it. Just astronomers looking at the sky with their telescopes and figuring out that there is stuff there which is not stones, is not stars, is not powder, is not light, is something else. And none of the theories we have seem capable of explaining what dark matter is. Well, great. fantastic.
You like that.
Something else to discover. there are some of my colleagues who says, well, we write down the final theory of everything. No, come on. We are far away from the final theory of everything. We are discovering step by step. We are solving problem one by one. And as has always happened in history for centuries, and it's still happening now, every time we seem to have put everything in order, there's something new that appears, something that we didn't think about or we hadn't seen before. And the dark matter is that. It's actually quite fantastic. We see these galaxies in the sky, and there's good evidence that around each galaxy is a sort of huge cloud. And we see the effects of this huge cloud, but we don't see the cloud itself. So what is it? We don't know. There are explanations, but there are maybe 10 different explanations, which means that we don't know which one is the right explanation.
It's and do we have enough? I mean, we have super colliders. We have this CERN. We have things like that. Do we need? Are we stuck without a newer tool, another toy for physicists?
No, we're not stuck at all. The new data are coming in from astrophysics, from telescope. The new instruments that are coming online rapidly. So we're not in a situation, in a static situation. We are in an evolving situation. Mm-hmm. For instance, now the astronomers, the radio astronomers, are putting all the big radio telescopes online together to make something which is like having a single telescope as large as the Earth. And with that, they're going to see with incredible precision, detail, very far away. And with that, they're going to look at the black hole in the center of the galaxy. And in a few years, we should be able to see it, to see right. The actual black hole, to see the black spot in the sky, which is a black hole, which is something that seemed impossible a few years ago. Science is not stuck, it's going ahead. But nevertheless, the more it goes ahead, the more it finds new things which are unclear and to be understood, like dark matter.
How do we know that the mathematics works for some of the stuff? I mean, certainly quantum mechanics, it's been right. But how do we know that we're not fooling ourselves? As Einstein once said, as far as the laws of mathematics refer to reality, they are not certain. And as far as they are certain, they do not refer to reality. How do we know that, you come up with this theory and you have great thoughts and theories and what? How do you know what actually is describing the reality of what we know? Given that we don't know what dark energy, dark matter is, how do we know that it's real, the stuff that we're describing?
It's a very good question. It's a very deep question. I think that the answer is that we are not looking for certainty. We are looking for good theories that work well, right? If you have a map of your country where you want to go, you don't want to be sure that the map is absolutely perfect, absolutely detailed. No, you just want it to work. And if it doesn't work, you look for a better map. And that's what we're doing. Our theory, it's a good description of what happens that allows us to make predictions. So we check the theory, right? Why do we think that Newton's theory is good? Well, because our car works, our buildings stay up, our airplane do fly, and all this is computed with Newton's equations, and so on. How do you know, how do we know the Maxwell equation work? Because we have computers and telecommunication. All this is done with Maxwell equations. So these equations work very, very, very well. Are they perfect? No, because we have found instances where they don't work in the very small, with very high energy, very high speed. So when we find that they don't work, well, we correct them. Mm-hmm. And we never think we're at the end of the road, but we think we do have a better and better picture as we go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Now, speaking of going ahead and getting a better picture, let's talk about your theory, the loop gravity, loop theory, prediction.
Yeah.
How do you test? How do you test whether your loops are there or not?
That's exactly what we want to do today. We have been working on the loop theory for decades now. The theory is in pretty good shape theoretically. The question is now, how do we test it? And there are a number of ideas, non-realized yet. One can use it for describing the early universe and try to find consequences of the theory in the cosmological observations. What we're doing is studying black holes, and we're very excited because we have realized that black hole may explode. Black holes are not forever. It's not like diamonds that are forever. Because of quantum mechanics, a black hole has a finite lifetime, and in fact, it may even explode suddenly. We believe so. We're not sure, but we believe so. And we are trying to figure out how it explodes and if we can see in the sky exploding black holes. If we could see that, this might confirm the theory. And we even have a little dream that some of the signals already observed by radio astronomers called fast radio burst might perhaps be these exploding black holes. So if we can confirm that with more observation and more calculation, that would be a way of checking the predictions of the theory.
Well, I look forward to you, you know, getting those observations and checking out the theory and coming back with a new book that describes that, finding that, you know. If you just give us a phone call if and when that happens soon.
All right, I will certainly do.
No, very serious, Carlo. It's always a pleasure talking to you, and it's a great book. You've outdone yourself. I thought the seven questions were good. This is even better.
Thank you very much. Wonderful talking to you. Good luck, and if I may, good luck with your new president.
Oh, thank you. Carlo Rovelli, author of the new book, Reality is Not What It Seems, and his past book, Seven Brief Lessons on Physics, both great books, both great subjects to talk about over the dinner table. The ocean is filled with creatures that stretch the imagination of us land-living bipeds. Maybe it's the deep sea anglerfish with its flickering fishing rod. Or a favorite around the sci-fi office, the octopus. Yeah, basically a tentacled brain trawling the seafloor. Well, I have another contender to add to the race of most bizarrely fascinating animal. You're going to think this is kind of cool. It's the seahorse. And I'm not nominating the fish, and yes, it is a fish, based on its giraffe-like snout or its monkey-like tail. Nope. Today, we're talking about pregnancy. Male seahorses are the ones who give birth to little swimming sea ponies. That's the topic of our video pick this week. Our video producer, Luke Raskin, visited the lab at Brooklyn College where they're rearing and studying seahorses. Must have been fun, Luke.
Oh, it definitely was.
Tell us about that. Just let me tell our listeners that you can watch Luke's video on our website at sciencefriday.com/seahorse. I don't think in most people I've ever heard that it's the male seahorse that's becoming pregnant.
Oh, yeah. They're the only vertebrates, seahorses and pipefish, which is a group of about 300 species, where the males become truly pregnant. There's lots of males around there that will protect their young or care for their young or provide for their young, but these are the only ones that actually truly become pregnant. They're the only ones that have an internal gestation, and they provide some sort of connection to their brood.
Mm-hmm. And they have other unique adaptations.
Oh, absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. So they have bony skin and scales, which is pretty not unique among fish, but it's not exactly common. They have no dorsal fins, they have no teeth, and their jaws are fused. So they have this one, like you said, kind of like almost giraffe-like mug that can extend their mouth, but their jaws are one single jaw. Mm-hmm. And as you mentioned, the seahorses have a prehensile tail, which they can use kind of like a monkey tail to grab onto things, and it's pretty flexible. But of course, everybody knows them for their pouch, their brood pouch. So male seahorses have a belly on them, it looks kind of like a belly. It looks exactly like a belly.
But I know you went out and filmed them, but I looked at the film. But it's not like it's a kangaroo pouch.
No, it's not like a kangaroo pouch. It really does. The best way to describe it, it just looks like a belly. It looks like they have this little belly. And that's one of the distinguishing characteristics between the males and the females. Mm-hmm. The males of seahorses have a belly, this little kind of fleshy belly that doesn't look bony, and then the females don't. Instead, the females have an ovipositor. So when a female and a male, they go through a mating ritual, they have an actual dance. It's very romantic. The female quickly deposits, at the end of which, the female deposits her eggs inside the pouch of the male, and he fertilizes it. Or he can actually decide not to, but that's another story. So when that happens, it happens very quickly, maybe 5 seconds. And once the embryos are in there, there's a lot of stuff going on there. And I spoke to Tony Wilson, whose lab I visited, and he explained to me all the really cool things that are going on inside the brood pouch of a seahorse.
So the embryos will implant in the brood pouch wall. So there's a close connection between the male's blood supply and the pouch. And then the male regulates the internal environment. He provides oxygen to the embryos during their development. He regulates the salinity such that when the offspring are released, the salinity within the pouch and outside the pouch is identical. He has contractions, which are very similar to what we see in terms of labor in humans. And once the offspring are released, you have little baby seahorses, which are completely free living.
Now, I saw the video and of the baby seahorses being born. It's something you got to see it to believe how this happens.
Yeah.
Describe it.
Well, it straddles the line between wondrous and completely disturbing. because it's, you know, it's all these adorable, beautiful little seahorses coming out. Yeah. But the male is going through these straight up contractions. It's bending its body over. It's seriously in labor. And it's forcing out, in some species, thousands of little babies out of its pouch. It's just spraying babies
pop,
out
pop,
into.
Pop, pop,
yes,
pop,
it really does look like they're just spraying out of him. And it's you don't forget it once you see it.
Talking with Luke Groskin on Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. It's our video pick of the week, sciencefriday.com/seahorse. Besides the males getting pregnant, seahorse pregnancy really seems similar to like other forms of pregnancy.
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. Yeah. There's been a lot, you know, as Dr. Wilson mentioned, there's a lot of care and actual, you know, biology that the male is actually applying to its babies. It's actually giving it lots of nutrients and resources. So there's that similarity. There's the fact that there's contractions, and then Dr. Wilson, he's looking also at the hormones and the genetics behind it. And his research has actually shown that about 5 to 10% of the genes that are involved in seahorse pregnancy are involved in other forms of pregnancy in other vertebrates, including mammals. So including one suite of genes, which is known to regulate prolactin. Now, what is that? It's prolactin. That's a hormone. That's the hormone, if you listen to it, prolactin, that's the hormone that promotes milk production in mammals. And what is a male seahorse doing with prolactin?
Maybe it's not a male. I mean, could it be that it's really not a male?
Oh,
thing?
See, now this is a horse of another color. Yeah, so
it's very fishy.
Yeah, there is something very fishy going on with its genes. They haven't actually found a sex chromosome, and they haven't actually found any genetic evidence for sex determination. You know, there are a lot of fish that where the males and females are decided by their environment, the temperature and things mm-hmm. like that. So they don't know how a male or how a seahorse, baby seahorse, becomes male or becomes female. And, you know, when I spoke to Dr. Wilson, he said, you know, I can't tell you for certain if basically a female seahorse, when it's born, doesn't develop sperm as it's developing. And so this kind of it's not really clear exactly how this system actually works. And if you look at the behavior of some of these species, the females are actually competing for the males, and everything is just completely topsy-turvy. It's a complete mystery, this whole system.
So it doesn't have the genes that say you're a male or you're a female.
They haven't found them
they
yet.
They haven't found
They're
them
doing genetics work. The seahorse genome was recently published on one species, and Dr. Wilson and his team are working on another species. And what they're hoping to do is do a little compare and contrast and hopefully hone in on what are the different genes that regulate different things in the seahorse and cause it to be a seahorse.
How much fun was it making this video? Was it a lot of work?
I think it was.
Did you enjoy it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It was enlightening to see this species. You know, it also is a really wonderful experience used to make some horrible dad jokes, which you can hear in the video.
You say there are five puns.
Yes, there's five dad jokes in there. If you can catch them, you're shamed publicly.
Not to mention all the fishy puns we said.
Oh, absolutely.
Today. It's Luke's video is up on our website at sciencefriday.com/seahorse. Thanks, Luke.
Thanks, Ira.
And you can also watch that latest video of male seahorses giving birth, as I say, on our website, sciencefriday.com/seahorse. And you can read about the pygmy seahorse, the smallest one out there. It's about the size of your pinky fingernail. It is one of the cutest little seahorses. It's just cool. Check it out at our website at sciencefriday.com. BJ Lederman composed our theme music. Our thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. If you'd like to get out the old pen and pencil, you can still write us the classic way, Science Friday, 19 West 44th Street, room 412, New York, New York, 10036. Or you can email us, scifry@sciencefriday.com. Go to our website or our Facebook page. Get in on the conversation going on all week. And, of course, we tweet @scifry. Have a great, enjoyable weekend. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.